To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract. I will read a couple of paragraphs from page 152 of the Big Book. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. Tonight's meeting is part two of working a step 12 with a sponsee. And Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be open for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Evening, kiddos. Tim Alcoholic. Okay, it's really ironic I'm doing some kind of workshop on sponsorship. I was just super crabby with a sponsee, probably a 7 out of 10. Like 10 is you're definitely going to be sacked as a sponsor. I was a 7 and I apologized and the words crawled out. I don't know what you're like when you're apologizing, but when I'm apologizing to a sponsee, it's like the words are crawling out of my mouth like spiders. They don't want to, it's not elegant. But I think it was a useful lesson. Whenever I find myself irritated with a sponsee, it's always because I haven't set the boundary properly in the first place, or I don't have a standard response. So there's so many things no longer annoy me because I've got a standard response. And one of the things that people do, and heaven knows, I probably did this for like 20 years. Have you ever gone to your sponsor because like something has happened or a situation has arisen or you've had an emotion or an event has occurred in the last 15 seconds and you're like, I know, I'll call my sponsor. And you haven't thought about it. You haven't processed it. You haven't done anything. You just like, you know, that you're just dropping it on the carpet in front of them. And if I'm caught off guard when someone did that today, and you know, we all do it, so it's not them in particular, but I just wasn't poised enough to respond appropriately, which would have been to simply send, I've got some auto text messages. It really helps, by the way, if you find yourself saying the same thing over and over and over again, just type the thing out, have it on a note with all of the auto text and just send it through like something like, this is probably a question you can investigate further. I'm available once you've investigated it further and have formulated a suitable question. If you need any more input for now, let me know. Like something like that would have totally sufficed. So the annoyance with sponsees is not coming from them. It's always coming from me because I'm not prepared. I haven't told them what is usual, what is customary for how sponsorship works. So it's always on me. So I always investigate after something has gone down and I've got all crabby. I always investigate what could I have done differently not to have got crabby in the first place. So the topic this evening, we've done, I can't remember what we did last week. It was sponsorship, wasn't it? A sponsorship of sponsorship. There you go. This week, so service. I think the first thing I have gone through the traditions and the concepts formally with people, but I don't like doing it. Other people love it. They as sponsees, they love it. As sponsors, they love it. I'm very wary myself of academic exercises for sponsees. I think by the time you get to step 12, with any luck at all, you should have acquired, a person should have acquired the skill to read the material themselves and figure out if they have any questions about how to apply it. So I've got a lot of material on the traditions and concepts, which I pass people, and resources, and the recordings, and there are various people, and there are things, lots of, like, Dennis F's written some great stuff on the traditions and the concepts. The concept stuff is eccentric, but it's very good. It's not kind of really on the concepts, it's on his version of the concepts. So there's lots of stuff you can give people. But the reason why going through it academically, I don't think is the right way of doing it, is because you have to study the concepts a little bit. But frankly, it's only when you have practical situations that they come alive in their application. And again, it's just like with everything else. So one thing people are inclined to do with the traditions and the concepts, because the traditions, just, you know, to cover off some basics, because people have got different levels of experience in this, even in this little group here. The traditions are the principles by which the group operates. The concepts are the principles by which the service structure operates, right? So they get to step 12. They're supposed to be sponsoring, your sponsees are supposed to be sponsoring other people at this point. And they're supposed to have some kind of group level service. And ideally also, especially if they've not done it before, to get involved in the service structure, whatever fellowship they're in. Now, how do you know they're doing enough service? They have a gazillion questions. If they don't have a gazillion questions, they either don't have enough service or they're not paying attention. Because I had a gazillion questions at group level and in the service structure. And it's just like with everything else. People have the habit of playing, look what the cat brought in. So they present you the raw situation. And the standard approach, if someone's got a group situation, of course, the temptation is, people present you with the raw situation. The temptation is to get in there and just tell, well, this is what you do, and this is how to look at this, and this is what's gone wrong, and blah, blah, blah. And it's that people don't learn anything that way. What I've learned to do, and this is a very good way of doing it. You say, have you read the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, specifically Bill W's traditions essays? Yeah, I've read those. And have you read Language of the Heart, the traditions, essays, and Language of the Heart? Slightly different. Yeah, I've read those. Okay, great. Have you got some worksheets and checklists? There are, like, traditions checklists published by GSO. Have you got those? Yeah, I've got those. Okay, great. So what you can do, you can take your situation, and then you can say to yourself, in your meditation in the morning, how does tradition one apply to this? How does common welfare arise in this situation? How does personal welfare relate to common welfare? How do they get balanced in this situation? And to run through all the principles of the traditions, and you'll discover in almost every case, people come up with the right answer and a better answer than you could have come up with if just because they know the situation, they know the group. For you to solve it, you'd have to extract a huge amount of information from them to perform the assessment yourself. So as with many other things, you're getting people to do the homework themselves. They'll hate that, because they just want to be told. That you get them to do the homework themselves. And then once they've finished the homework, you say to them, right, okay, well, I agree with all of that except, you know, this, that, and the other. Maybe you add a couple of extra things on top, or that's great in theory, but in practice, dot, dot, dot. Or so you can, they've got to take the work to the furthest point they can get themselves, and then you come in. And there was a reading, actually, which is so relevant to this, which I came across. I, rather through gritted teeth, I subscribed to some Buddhist Facebook things as a place to sort of mine lots of quotations for the morning meeting. And some of them I can't even begin with, but some of them are amazing. And there was one that I found today, which is probably the most useful thing I've ever heard about sponsorship, and it's not about sponsorship. Just finding it out, I'll post it in the chat. in a, just a moment. Before talking to the teacher, it is better to observe yourself a bit. In that way, you might find the answer for yourself. It is better to be one's own teacher or master rather than assigning the job to someone else. That is why the teacher, and above all a so-and-so teacher, some branch of Buddhism, teaches us to observe ourselves and to discover our own condition and always asks us all to become responsible for ourselves. Why do teachers ask these things? It is not because they are worried about being bothered, but because they know very well that always turning to one's teacher is not a solution. The solution lies in observing ourselves and resolving our own problems by ourselves. Then if we have, and this is the key point, if we have no way of finding a solution, the teacher can certainly help us. If everyone did this, it would be much easier. And I think one of the reasons why Buddhist books and teachings generally can be so useful in AA. It's not so much the transcendental stuff about, you know, the states of being and consciousness, and those are all very fun, but it's because there's a big teaching tradition, which is very similar to sponsorship. So what they learn about how the relationship between the person who's further ahead and the person who's just learning is, they've made all the mistakes. That comes from, like, I don't know how many thousand years of mistakes and Buddhist teachers getting exasperated and calling each other and saying, I can't believe this. Oh, that's where it comes from. It all sounds like so peaceful, doesn't it? And so wise. No, it's just like us. It comes from states of extreme annoyance and I can't believe it. So I highly recommend to go onto Facebook, put Buddhist quotations and get them onto your live stream. It's much better than anything about American politics, apparently. Anyway, so basically you get people to do a load of group level service and a load of service structure service, and they end up, the process just runs itself as long as you push back at the right points. So the two this is a bit like Goldilocks. Remember Goldilocks, where the first porridge was too hot and the second porridge was too cold and the third porridge was just right and the first bed was too hard and the second bed was too soft and the third one was was just right. And it's like that with sponsors, particularly once they got to step 12. Some want to hang off your coattails and ask you absolutely everything, and others ask you nothing and go around causing havoc and then telling everyone you're their sponsor. That's fun. especially the ones with borderline personality. As a friend of mine says, only happy when everyone else is in complete chaos. So one thing, if someone wants me to continue sponsoring them at step 12, we have a very awkward conversation sometimes. If I smell trouble, most people are fine. But if I smell trouble, I have this conversation. And I have this conversation as well about this notion of service sponsorship. If your sponsor, like, literally doesn't do service structure stuff, you want a separate service sponsor. But if your sponsor does, why do you want a different sponsor? That's interesting, isn't it? You know, it's the divide and rule thing. Left hand doesn't see what the right hand is doing. I had a sponsee once who was an Al-Anon sponsee, but they were also an AA and they were also doing service. And they were doing service in my kind of vicinity. And there was their service conduct did not blend with the setting. Let's just put it like that. There were things that they were doing which might be valid in their own right, but were not working super well in the context. How's that for? You see, I can be tactful if I want to be. And we had to have the tricky conversation is this. If I'm going to be sponsoring you at all, how about we get to look at everything? Because all of the psychological stuff going on in your personal life is going to manifest in your service stuff. The service behavior is a mirror of what is going on in your private life. Which is what, and it's one of the reasons why it's super helpful to have sponsees, at least for a while, come to your home group. I had someone that had terrible trouble with work colleagues, not an uncommon problem. And they felt very sort of victimized and disliked by people in the workplace. Again, not an uncommon situation. And the person was very nice, very, you know, worked very hard at the program, but we all have blind spots. I have blind spots. And this person's blind spot was about social interaction. And I saw them at the meeting, and they were sitting on their own about 70 feet away from everyone else. There are 40 or 50 people there, all chatting, buzzing around, eating sugar. So they were chatty. Cakes, biscuits, tea, coffee, having a lovely time. They were sitting on their own, just looking down like a sort of wraith. And I got a text from a friend saying, so-and-so's at the meeting says they're feeling completely alone. And I thought, well, this isn't a hard one to diagnose. Now, everyone's ignoring me. Well, they were, and I was literally there. They were, because this person had separated themselves from the group. They could have gone and joined the throng with all us other crazy people, but they'd separated themselves. And a couple of people went to say hello to them, but that this person just could have brushed them off. And because I could see that going on, we could have a conversation about, is it possible you're doing that in the work environment too? You're creating the situation where you're rejected because it reinforces the existential position that you developed as a child that everyone rejects you. So you're recreating it because it's comfortable. And we could have a useful conversation. So it is useful to have sponsees, if they're doing step 12, to be in eyeshot in terms of group level service. Or service structure service. Not always, it's not obligatory, but it's helpful. If you can't do that, maybe they do need a separate service sponsor who can actually see them in action. And with the service structure, I think that's pretty much it. You throw them in, they try and do as much as possible. Oh, the Goldilocks thing. I didn't really finish that off properly. So some people come to you with nothing. Some people come to you with everything, and you want something in between. So you want people to be genuinely considering the option of checking stuff out. If people don't know how to calibrate that, people don't always know how to calibrate that. So you have to help them say, if ever you don't know what to do and you run it through your little algorithm, tradition one, tradition two, tradition three, and you're still stuck, then we'll talk about that. But also, if you discover other people reacting to you, so even though you didn't cause their reactions, you can't control them, you can't cure them, you did elicit them. And this is something I've learned when I'm eliciting a reaction. Yes, it's true. In Al-Anon, I didn't cause it, but there's a reason why they're reacting like that to me and not to someone else. So there's always something for me to look at when someone reacts badly. It's very common. And this is so the Al-Anons amongst you, I'm not going to name names because I know how embarrassing it is. The Al-Anons amongst you with Al-Anon sponsees, because what we learn, you know, I mean, even in AA, we learn that, you know, page 67, other people are sick, blah, blah, blah. In Al-Anon, do we learn that. The danger is thinking that when other people are reacting badly towards you, well, it's obviously them. You know, you so learn not to take things personally that you actually stop examining your own conduct. And that's a danger with people who are AA and Al-Anon. I say the AA seem to be much more sensitive about that, funnily enough, and because the Al-Anons have often applied a manual override to block their awareness of their impact on other people in situations where there are other alcoholics or addicts around. I've seen that so often, I'm pretty sure it's a pattern. Also, the AAs generally, and this isn't a hard and fast rule, the AA sponsees, the risk is they'll try and get away with doing the service by doing the absolute minimum to get by. And that's going to cause a completely different set of problems to the Al-Anon personality types. And I've got a little bit of both. I can be very, very sloppy at times and then overly controlling at other times. The Al-Anon types are much more likely to, you turn your back and they're now chair of the region. And no one asked them. There was a hostile takeover. People have you come back 2 weeks later and a second region has been established because everyone is so angry at what happened in the first region. So you've really got to watch the ones with the Al-Anon stripe down their back. And the longer they've been in, the more you have to watch them. I told you this story maybe a few weeks ago when I was with Tom in San Francisco. I'd had a run-in with someone that was 22 years sober. And I was in the car with Tom, and he said, 22 years, that's when you think you know everything. So sometimes the sponsees who are in service, who've been doing service for a long time, are really difficult to sponsor because there's just a baked-in way of doing things. And often people are unsponsorable in service after a certain point, unless they start to experience real problems. But I think that's pretty much it on the service sponsorships side of things. Just one little tip. One little tip. When people have got a situation, and this is true for service sponsorship, it'll be true for other areas we're going to discuss in step 12, but it's also true in steps 8 and 9. And also, actually, I'll tell you a little story about the fourth column in step 4. Sometimes people have enormous trouble connecting with what they did wrong in a situation, which totally makes sense because if you'd known what was right and wrong, you probably wouldn't have made all the mistakes in the first place. So actually, the default position when you get to the fourth column and you say to someone, so what did you do wrong? Well, I don't know. Of course not. If you'd known, you wouldn't have done it. So that's actually, we shouldn't be surprised when they say that. But I tried an experiment this week. I've done it before, but this was a spectacular, well, I think it was a spectacular success. Well, time will tell. Someone couldn't see what was going on in the fourth column. So I told them, spend an hour or so, write down who's involved, names, and what their role was in the situation. And then tell me the facts in the order that the facts happened without commentary or explanation, except as far as necessary to understand the actual acts themselves. Forget motivations. Just this happened, this happened, this happened. And they did a bloody good job, I have to say. It was remarkable. And it was immediately, I think there probably were 30 or 40 things which had gone wrong in this situation, which they hadn't spotted. Now, in step 4, that's the trick, is get them to tell the story, and then you can walk them through, okay, this would have been a red flag. This would have been a red flag. Another red flag, a further red flag. No, this is the point you should have exited the situation. You stayed, okay, that was the mistake. And you can talk them through it. Steps 8 and 9, exactly the same thing, particularly in romantic situations, is you get them to do a kind of walk through exactly what happened in the order that things happened, and you can spot immediately what's gone wrong. And you do the same thing in service situations. Who's involved? What are the roles? And then the facts in the order that they happened. And if they're a bit more advanced, you can say to them, right, tell me how the traditions apply to this. Tradition 1, tradition 2, tradition 3, tradition 4. And then if it's service structure, concept 1, concept 2, concept 3, concept 4. And then you've got something to come in on. And this gives people a format, which actually I find works pretty well. So I think that's all I've got on the service structure. I've got material on practicing as principals and all our affairs, but maybe we should cover off the service structure questions if there are any first. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, Tim. So, yeah, if anyone has any questions for Tim on the service structure that he's spoken about, yeah, James.
Thanks, Alistair. Thanks. Sorry, thanks, Tim. Thanks for that presentation. My question is, when a sponsee is looking at being of service, do you think there is anything to be gained by suggesting the person maybe starts at the group level before deciding to say, oh, there's a GSR position, or do you think just allow the person's own journey of recovery to sort of dictate where they take service as the positions arise in their local meetings or in their local intergroup?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think one should proceed systematically through the service structure. So you can get service. One shouldn't be a GSR unless one's been the secretary or chair of a group, first of all. So one shouldn't launch into that. You should have had to sit at the front for a year and just have to run the group. You shouldn't take on, I think it is a good idea to spend maybe a year, 6 months to a year, maybe probably a year actually at intergroup as a GSR. So you come into intergroup as a GSR. Ideally spend a year, just figuring out what's going on. I made a complete, if you'll pardon my French, arse of myself in the first intergroup that I belonged to in 1994, 94, 95. I went as a very, kind of very, I was like a year and a half sober or something. And I had no idea of the dynamics. I had no idea what it was about. And boy, did I launch in. Everything I said that went down really badly. And then they got crabby with me. And then I got crabby with them. So you really want to test the waters for a while in intergroup. It is possible to take on like one of the officerships of the intergroup. But only if there's no competition and serious important work is not getting done, like the detox is, there's no meeting in the detox because they haven't got a liaison officer and someone needs to do it and no one else is going forward. So ideally one should wait a little bit before doing the officerships, but the needs of the alcoholic who's suffering at the end of the line come first and you can learn it quickly on the job if necessary. A lot of it depends on the person's external experience. There's this myth in AA that everyone is equally qualified for all jobs and one shouldn't sort of discriminate against people for lack of relevant experience. And it's just untrue. If you've got someone that can't type, can't use a computer, can't produce documents, terrible at using email, can't organize themselves, do not make them the secretary of intergroup. Got that? If someone is terrible with money, is broke, is massively in debt and has a tiny gambling problem, maybe you don't want them to be the treasurer of the intergroup. If someone still is experiencing very severe personality disorder manifestations, again, you don't want them in an outward facing role where they're communicating AA to the public because the risk is they'll create, it's like the people who are well can create a bad enough impression as things are. You really don't want to go in there with a poison chalice. So I think it depends very much on where the person is in their life, what kind of jobs they're suitable for, and to ease into it. The jobs at intergroup or whatever the equivalent area, district, blah, blah, blah. Those jobs, there are internal jobs and then there are outward facing jobs. One should only take on the outward facing liaison officer roles if one is very confident that one's got at least the basic principles of how intergroup operates, because the fellowship's reputation is on the line. You can muck up electronic communications liaison, which is an internal role with no outward facing role. If you mess that up, it doesn't really matter. If the microsite is not as usable as it could be, if you can fix those things because they're just temporary internal glitches. But also the other thing, what you can do, and I think this is a super thing to get people to do, is to go to the intergroup anyway, and the liaison officers are usually looking for volunteers to do schools talks, to go on walkabouts, like public information walkabouts. There's often grunt work that needs to be done, so people can get that people can observe how the role is done by someone competent before they actually launch into it. Then it's much less scary. And if you go and say, I'm not available to be an officer, but I'm available to volunteer to help out, like whatever officer needs someone to help out with stuff, you can do that. And a year sober, I was my second year of sobriety, so between 1 and 2 years, I was the sort of Santa's little helper of the London Region South and London Region North employment liaison officers. So I worked for a big city firm which had databases, and I mined, it was perfectly legal. I mean, I wasn't like mining confidential information, but like public access databases of companies and corporate registrations and so on. And I would mine those for lists of employers to go to, and, you know, with details of HR departments and things like that to help them out. So I did a lot of work in my second year, putting together packs for HR packs for human resources department, AA packs for the human resources departments in all the city banks. This was in 1994, 1995, 1996. So you can get super involved in service without having a formal officership. So you can get the experience that way. So there's nothing, even if someone isn't temperamentally suited, the one thing I would say about getting into the service structure, there's a limit to the amount of damage you can do at group level, but there's a lot of damage that can be done at intergroup if someone with an emotional screw loose starts to get involved. I've seen the most, you see intergroups collapsing because of one person, and it's difficult to kind of get them out of the machinery. Once they're in the machinery, it's difficult to get them out. So to do a serious role at intergroup, one must, I personally believe, have completed all of the amends and not have any emotional handicaps cropping up and hamstringing you at every available opportunity, because it's just the risk of affecting other people is just too great. So that one must exercise caution with this, encouraging people to, I've over encouraged people to do service when they weren't mentally or psychologically ready for it. And funnily enough, the people that don't think they're ready are usually the ones that are ready, and the ones that think they're super ready, you might want to have a, you know, listen very carefully to what's going on, because there can be anyone that's super keen to do service, I'm a little bit suspicious of, because my own motivations were not entirely clean. It was, oh great, here's something I can take charge of, which is not really a great motivation. So does that answer your question, James?
Yes, thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim. Did anyone else have a question for Tim on that topic?
What I can do, I've got a set of topics of other areas. So there's practicing these principles in all our affairs. I've got a set of 9 topics. Which I'm actually going to copy into the chat box. If anyone can suggest further topics, that would be great. And these are topics which people come to you with, and there are kind of standard ways of helping people approach these. But sorry, Rivka, you got a question?
Yeah, hi, thanks, Tim. I do have a question, but I'm not sure if the question is appropriate for the topic, but I'll just ask it, and if it's not, you can ignore me, or ignore it. So the question is, the subject was raised, is it normal, say there's an intergroup, and the intergroup has to decide on some issue coming up. So is it normal for people in the intergroup to speak to each other privately and sort of lobby the way that a political body would? You know, I'm from the U.S., so I think of Congress and Senate. There's a lot of lobbying going on, and before a bill is passed there, it's pretty much decided what's going to happen. It's just a question if they have the vote. So that question came up, is that okay to do? Is it a normal thing to do? Should one go to an intergroup meeting and hear about a topic for the first time and then everybody discusses it? Or is it okay for people to call each other and say, listen, here's my opinion, and I was thinking we should really vote this way or that way?
An amazingly good question. You said you weren't sure if it was appropriate for this topic. I'm not sure I'm appropriate to be talking about any of this stuff, but I am. So let's just deal with what is. So that's a great question. And it's one that arises very, very commonly. I think probably the number one difficulty that I encounter amongst sponsees in in groups and in the service structure is back channels. So the traditions and the concepts are very clear. You have a group conscience, and at the group conscience meeting, you have, this is concept 12, discussion, vote, and substantial unanimity. That's where the decision gets made. It does not get made. I mean, small administrative things can be done in other ways. And if it's not a group or an intergroup, then it can be done in other ways. But if it's a formal part of the structure, you've got to be absolutely squeaky clean about how these things are done. So lots of groups now have either Facebook groups or WhatsApp groups or whatever, and lots of decisions get made on there. And it's a disaster because people say things they would not say to each other face to face. Occasionally, if you can have things decided on WhatsApp, if things are relatively uncontentious, if people are super mature, and if you've got mechanisms for so you go straight to polling straight away, like anonymous polling on you know, polling websites. So the first 164 is not a group, so it doesn't abide by the traditions, but we try and follow the principles in as far as the setup allows. And so if anything starts to get remotely contentious, boom, let's have a poll. Rather than the acrimony being starting to come out in the discussions themselves. So you sound out what is going on with a poll first, and then everyone quietens down. Oh, so everyone does want X, Y, and Z. It's complete. So it's a way of, if you're going to use WhatsApp groups, that's a super way of doing it. You go straight into polling to sound out people's general views. But anyway, the point is, but that works very, very rarely. You've got to have, if there was any trouble on first 164, it got contentious, I'd switch and start having organizing Zoom calls with everyone there. But I don't think that level of organization is necessary. I might be wrong. If anyone's on here that really wants those, let me know. You know, we'll talk about that. We'll have a poll about that. But what you're talking about there is, it's the whole notion of back channels, and the back channels can be the WhatsApp group, which becomes the alternative to the business meeting or the group conscience. People twittering in corridors, and you've always had this. It's just electronic communications have made it easier for people to misbehave in this way. Now, the reason this is not super straightforward is because you've got to strike a balance here, and the balance, you're very right, you've got a note of caution in what you said. Do people turn up cold to the topic? No. You need an informed group conscience. So the way this is how it works, I think, healthily, if someone proposes something, there is a formal method for proposal. So let's say for the March business meeting, by the February business meeting, someone needs to send the secretary a written proposal, and that gets circulated in writing so that everyone's got a month to think about it, to talk to their sponsor, to talk to their friends. But under no circumstances, and I've done this, and it's poison to the individual, it's poison to me when I've done it. I've lobbied other people, and other people have done it with me. And I just don't think it's right. I think you have your view and you discuss the view, but the answer is not to try to, it's this old pattern, which is so useful. I'm there to offer an idea and explain the idea, but not convince anyone or persuade anyone. It's up to the other person whether they buy it or not. And so lobbying is where it tips over in trying to convince or persuade you, trying to stack business meetings or group conferences, making sure certain people show up. Now, the other reason this isn't straightforward. There are times where, for the good of unity and smooth functioning, a little bit of discussion needs to take place between the officers of group about how to handle a particularly contentious question. But that's not about achieving a particular result. It's about establishing an orderly process which maintains a cordial atmosphere in the group. That's completely different. I think you can consult very heavily and politically, as it were, on process, but in order that the group conscience then be expressed however it wants to be expressed without trying to swing it one way or another. So it's the nature of the discussions in between the meetings that matters. It's not whether or not they happen. I think they have to happen, first of all, so that people can sound out the ideas. It's only when you discuss them that you realize you're crazy. When you hear someone else's perspective, you realize you're crazy. So you have to discuss them. You've certainly got to discuss the logistical side of things. And word community, you know, I've often taught as a secretary who is in charge of the written communications of group. I've consulted very judiciously about exactly how to word things, about how to structure group conscience meetings. But again, it's not about the result. It's about the process. So this isn't a straightforward topic at all. But the aim is to have an informed group, maximally informed group conscience. One way, by the way, to put the kibosh on any of that lobbying which goes on, and this is a great technique. You send something to all group members saying, we'd love to have your comments in writing. We'll take them, we'll anonymize them, and we'll circulate them so that everyone knows what everyone thinks. And it takes the wind out of the sails of little secret plans. And also, what's very interesting is that when one is voting in a group conscience meeting, this is not well understood. When one is voting, one should be voting for the good of all. So I will often vote, and my conscience is what my conscience tells me is for the good of all. It's not what I think. So I often vote for proposals that I personally disagree with because I feel that that's what the group wants. So I want to go with what the group wants. And if you adopt that approach, there's nothing to lobby for. Not to have a personal angle, only to be looking to maximize. Jim Willis says, your job is to help the rest of God's kids get their heart's desire. And as long as it doesn't harm them, help them get it. So if the group wants to make a decision you don't personally agree with, but, you know, it's so clearly what they want, I go with it. And if with that approach, you're removing the problem at source, which is having a personal objective. That's where the lobbying is coming from. It's having a personal personal investment of some sort. Does that make sense, Arifka? Good. Alistair, shall I go on to the, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 topics. So we've got more than tonight's worth. And if other people have got topics, then, you know, please tell me and I'll add them to list. Money. Most sponsees at some point come to you with money problems. I am not a money advisor. However, when people have got money problems, I get them to look at a couple of things. In step four, it says, suggests that we take a business takes inventory and my finances are like a business. And this single exercise, if it's followed, I has always worked with people with money problems, is for 1 year to write down every single penny that is spent by whatever means, cash, cards, whatever else, and to analyze those in a spreadsheet or by some other, with an abacus, you know, whatever means you want, so that you can look at what you're actually earning, what you're actually spending, and then to apply the line throughout the year. From page 64 of the big book, we cannot fool ourselves about values. So when someone gets to the end of the month and they've spent £647 having coffees in cafes, have you got £647 of value out of that? And it completely, they don't have to do anything. It's so often with, and this is true with all of these problems. If you look at the facts actually tell you the answer. Most alcoholics in my experience, and I'm like this, I deny the facts, I suppress the facts, I tell a story in the moment, and that's where all the behavior is coming from. It's coming from old narratives like, I need to spend this money because otherwise I'll feel so deprived. And what's the point in working all these hours and having a job I hate with people I hate if I can't spend? It's my money, I can spend it. And then, you know, as Bob B says, oh, the other thing, listen to Bob Byzance on money. He's very good on money. Now, what's so interesting, Anthony DeMello, who's very naughty, Anthony DeMello talks about how people don't want to get out of kindergarten. Everyone says they want to get out of the kindergarten, but what they really want is they want to get their relationship back. They want to get their job back. They want this from the world. They want that from the world. I've given the money exercise to maybe, I know, probably hundreds of people. Only a small proportion of people have actually done it. It's very interesting. People with very bad money problems refuse to do what for our grandparents would have been an absolute standard thing about how to act like an adult. You balance your checkbook. You write down where everything is going. You budget. You forecast. You do all of these things. So you can only help people if they want to be helped and if they'll do the work themselves. The other side of money, I think, is work. And the book is very good on this. It talks about people who get sober and want to that they either go to one extreme, they go to a spiritual extreme, or they go to a financial extreme and try to overperform financially. With the overperformance, what I typically find with sponsees that go too far down that road, eventually they'll have a nervous breakdown. And you can kind of warn them in advance. You know, you're like 18 months off a nervous breakdown. You do know you're 18 months off a nervous breakdown. Oh, no, I'm fine. And then there's a nervous breakdown and then they forget that you told them. Most people get through that and it kind of stabilizes. The much harder problem on the money side is connected with the what's called in another fellowship under earning. And a lot of people come into recovery with a career busting gap in their CV. Friend of mine got sober at 40. And I said, so what have you been we're just talking. I was saying, so tell me about your drinking. He said, well, last 20 years, I've really mostly just sat on the sofa and watched TV. And that's literally what he did all day. He went out to get drink and then he got back and watched TV. This does not look super good on your CV. There's not a lot you can do to dress that one up. Most people have a white whale from the, I've never read Moby Dick. I understand there is a white whale in it and the white whale is not super friendly. You know, it's not one of those Disney films. Let's put it that way. And the white whale is your sort of nemesis, the area of your life. And someone can have more than one. I had like four nemeses, four areas. I'm not going to go into them now. Work is a massive problem for some people, particularly the what do I do with my life? There's nothing I want to do. My CV is terrible. I don't have any qualifications. I'm not fit to do anything. I haven't worked for 10 years. I haven't worked for 30 years, that kind of thing. Now, you can't solve this from the outside. You can't force it. The person has got to want, basically has to get painful enough, like not facing it, has to become more painful than facing it. And facing it is terrifying. And I had to work was my one. I grew up with the attitude, if you're clever, the world will just give you a career. And you don't have to actually be able to do anything. You'll just kind of get something which pays you money on the basis of, academic quality. Of course, this is not the case. And I hadn't really worked. I had worked somewhere, but I'd stolen as much as I worked in the place that I worked. Apparently, you're not supposed to do that. So I had no, when I got sober, I had no real experience. And the whole process of applying for jobs and going to work was unbelievably painful, but I had no alternatives. I had no other source of income. My parents had no ability to support me. So I had to do it. And I felt physically sick. I remember leaving careers libraries and vomiting because the whole thing filled me with such terror. But here's the thing. You can do it. You can be terrified and do it on the same day. You don't have, and this is true with all of these problems in these other areas. The answer doesn't lie in get comfortable with what the solution is and then you do the solution. You have to do the solution, even though it's horrible. I've got a list that I send people with, like, if you're stuck with like career and not earning enough money, here are 40 things that healthy people do to try to figure out what to do with their life, to get a job, to work out where to study, to work out where to volunteer. And with lots of these areas, the job is to work out what healthy people do and copy them, even though it's painful. All you can do is kind of give people the list of things to do, support them and help them work through the psychological blocks. And the big psychological block with solving any of these problems, in my experience, is the hobnail boots of negativity. I don't know if any of you, I know all of you are super positive, but I have a tiny negative streak. And the way it works is this. When I've got a problem, I'll go to someone with a solution and that whatever angle they come at me with the solution with, I'll tell them why that won't work with me. So there's always some reason why the solution proposed won't work. And by the time we've gone through every option, I'm back at square one with the existing problem, but now I've tried everything. Of course, I haven't tried everything. I've rejected every possibility. So sometimes one has to be basically super positive with people. Say, look, you must try these things. Try them. Like with job processes, I'm talking to someone at the moment who's doing amazingly well with this, amazingly well. I'll tell you, this job thing of people who've got like 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 35 years gap in their CV. Very few people will face it. The ones that do should frankly get a medal for bravery because it's a very painful thing to face. But it's a matter as a sponsor. I think what this is where you turn into sort of super positive parent mentoring role. Say, look, try it. If you don't think you can do it, fine. Let the interviewer decide whether they think you can do it. Because you might be wrong. If you're right, then the interviewer will agree with you, but at least you'll have had interview practice. And so to push the solution as far as possible, wait for the world to say no rather than saying no yourself. There is something, let's see if I can find it. I might not be able to. Oh, yes. I found I was researching something for work. I read Swedish and I found this Swedish website. And about real estate, property management. And I found this extraordinary quotation from a woman who was 28, 29. Why did you choose the real estate management program? And her answer was this. I actually looked through all the prospectuses in Sweden. Now that's a statement. All the prospectuses in Sweden are marked up all the universities and study programs that interested me. In the end, I had to choose between tourism and real estate management at Karlstad Business School. The salaries in the real estate sector and the huge need for new staff eventually led me to choose real estate management. That's how you do it. She did the footwork first. So with solving people's problems, you can't solve their problems. They have to solve their problems. My job as a sponsor is to increase their hope that solutions are available in the hope that they'll take the actions. That's all you can do. One thing that if you sponsor a lot of people, you'll probably discover over the years is people will come to you with the same problem again and again and again. And you feel like it's Groundhog Day. You've had this conversation 47 times before. And that's fine. But the important thing, I think, with any of these is to insist on action first. And as the action is being taken, you can talk about the psychological stuff. But you've got to kickstart it with the actions, just like with the steps. People got problems going to meetings. They've got to be going to meetings, and then you can discuss the problems they've got at the meetings. And this way, everything gets solved and faced. As I said, the action is incredibly painful. So you get people to put if it's particularly difficult, if they're particularly unable to take the action, to put all the support structures in place and maybe start the actions a little bit here, a little bit there. I remember, you know, when I started to face the career, I had to face the career thing a second time when I was in my 30s, because of a series of relatively undramatic but nonetheless noticeable nervous breakdowns in the career that I was having. When I faced it the second time, it was easier, but still, I could do some days I could only take an hour's effort, then I had to kind of run around recovering from the hour's effort that I'd made, and then I could do another hour's effort later on, and that's fine. If all you can do right now is 4 hours a week to solve the problem rather than 35, fine. But do the 4 hours, then next week do five. Next week do six. So to gradually, if you can't go 0 to 60, build up. And this really is the model for helping people with any of these problems, is to identify what the problem is. Find people in the universe who have solved the problem and copy what they did. And then you can help them just with human support and a bit of kind of AA pop psychology about positive thinking, relying on God, keeping it in the day, make a list of things to do, do the things on the list systematically. Do you know what I mean? It's like really basic stuff, but you can't solve the problems. You put them in a position where they can access the people who can solve the problems. So that's all I think I'd say about the money and the money one. Sex is next, but that's for next week. So invite all your friends. We've got money, sex, food, dating, relationships, exercise. That'll be a popular one. Drama. And by drama, I don't mean Central School of Drama or RADA or Shakespeare or those. I mean, I don't know if you've ever known people who have two or three traumatic incidents a day, and they're just constantly, they have multiple mobile phones and they're constantly calling lots of people about all the different dramas. But again, what we're going to talk about is how to deal with dramatic sponsees and families, which is a topic, and children, which is, by the way, the children one, in case you're wondering. What I say to people is 100% don't know. Go and talk to someone with 1,000 children and they'll tell you what to do. I do not know. So we can cross that list off. So we've got, I think, 7 topics left for next week. Alistair.
Thank you, Tim. You think we'll get through it all next week?
No. Do you want to see if we've got any questions on? I know we're at time, but if there are any specific questions on money and career?
Yes. I actually had one, Tim, if on money. Working with someone who has been entirely reliant on Social Security, and it might have been possibly, if it hasn't been addressed by the point that they reach step 12, and have you ever faced or felt like uncomfortable with someone being entirely on Social Security?
Well, one's got to keep one's own political views out of this, mm-hmm. So that one can be a little bit naughty about that. Must be looked at apolitically, I think. One mustn't go into the sort of that side of things at all. One observation is it's very unusual for people to get sober if they're 100% supported, if there's no consequences to the actions financially. If they do, then you're basically just kicking the problem down the road. And where you have this problem is people who are supported by family, supported by the state, or independently wealthy, so they don't need to work. And it's obviously these are not bad positions, but they do present a legitimate problem. And the legitimate problem is this: I am relentlessly self-obsessed. I mean, it's not
Tim, we lost you. You're back.
Oh, you're back. Okay. So I'm relentlessly self-obsessed. It's just not even funny after all this time. But the thing which enables me to live, I think, a pretty good life is the fact that I'm well occupied. My time is well occupied. And a big chunk of that time is spent on work and sponsorship at the moment, a little bit of service, but mostly on sponsorship. And talking to other people who aren't sponsees. And that keeps me out of trouble. Now, the reason why this is relevant, so if you've got sponsees who are not occupied with either work, study, or volunteering, is I don't know how to not be self-obsessed when my life revolves around the things which are for me, even though all the things I'm doing are good. You know, friends and family and looking after myself and hobbies and interests, they're not bad things, they're great things. But it's terribly difficult to get over mental obsessions of various types, relationship problems, problems with family, it's a very common thing, problems with money, problems with all sorts of things. We need time away from ourselves to look at ourselves properly, in my belief. So that's why I think it needs to be addressed. It's not so much out of the giving back to society side of things, although that's a relevant factor as well. So being of maximum service to God. But it's getting out of self. And even, you know, if someone were filling their life with service and sponsorship, that doesn't do it either, because that's still got too much personal stuff in it. The point about work is doing things which are kind of, any job, if you do it for long enough, becomes menial and boring. And I think this is a great thing because it teaches you how to continue to engage in things which are not super interesting to you in the moment. And it's the best way to get, for me, it's the best way to get out of self. So I think it does need to be addressed one way or another, but you can't force it from the outside. You have to present the idea that maybe an occupation, even if it's volunteering, it's not a, I don't think it's a money thing. If someone volunteers for 35 hours a week in soup kitchens and various other things, there are lots of opportunities around here there are a lot of poor people around here. There are a lot, I can, you know, give you a list of churches where they do soup kitchens and things. It doesn't matter what it is, but to occupy oneself is the key. I think that's the core of step 12. And my sponsor says, a much more important demonstration of our principles lies in our respective homes, occupations and affairs. And therefore, we've got to have occupations and affairs while there is no raw material for us to be working the program on and being of use to other people. It's the, I think, the work, study, volunteering. It's like pedaling the bicycle, which makes the lamp on the bicycle light up. And it's that lamp which attracts sponsees. So very often the work problem is connected to not having sponsees. It's very rare for people who are not working, studying and volunteering to have like loads of sponsees, unless they're sober 30 years, because the pedaling isn't happening to turn the light on. It's the activity in the world which turns the light. I mean, people's whole jiggy changes as soon as they're engaging in those efforts. I'm watching it at the moment. Someone, their whole energy has changed because they're engaging in this kind of work, which is really impressive. So that's all I got on that question.
Thanks, Tim. Does anyone else have a question on that topic? Okay, you're moving on. A bit past the hour. Thank you very much, Tim. And with that, I would hand the meeting back to you to close with the serenity prayer.
Thank you. So come back this time next week for sex and food. Would you please help me close with the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, Tim.